It's game time. This is The Game on News Radio KMAN.
Guys, it's a natural thing, but I think we're already taking Deuce Vaughn for granted. I think we're taking the explosiveness and the impressive nature of what K-State's true freshman is doing already for granted. And I realized that while reading a great story in The Athletic by our friend Max Olson, who you've heard a couple of times on the show now. Tremendous feature story about Deuce Vaughn. And I was also reading something from Ian Boyd of Inside Texas, does some work for Football Outsiders, where he was talking about the great all-around game that Deuce Vaughn had against Kansas. And I was like, man, we haven't really said one word about that. We haven't talked about Deuce Vaughn against Kansas at all because a 150 total yard performance with a touchdown with an insane open field move on Gavin Potter is just old hat by this point. So I feel guilty. I feel guilty, and we're going to talk about that today. Welcome into The Game. John Kurtz, Mitch Fortner here with you. Tweet me at JL Kurtz. Tweet us at The Game KMAN. Today on the show, Curry Sexton will join us. I am actually going to talk a little bit of baseball because, I mean, when baseball turns into just a total bleep show like it was last night on a number of different levels, I'm interested. Baseball had me interested. Number one song of the day, Ask Us Anything, all coming up on the show here today. So I do think it's very natural when you have a spectacular player to get very used to spectacular things happening. I'm a Chiefs fan. A lot of people around here are Chiefs fans. You see it happen every Sunday with Patrick Mahomes. He does four or five things that, you know, 5 years ago, if a Chiefs quarterback were to ever do in a game, it would be stop the presses, everything that we would talk about for weeks. But Mahomes just does it on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. So it's not that big of a deal. I think the same effect is already taking place with Deuce Vaughn, which is just evidence as to how damn good he is and the fact that he has the potential to really live up to the billing of what Chris Klieman once said, which is being a generational player. Like, what we're seeing from him is the stuff of being a generational player and being the guy to really jumpstart Chris Klieman's program. Like, being the first big star of Chris Klieman's program here in Manhattan. Like, here are some stats, okay? And this all came from the article in The Athletic. Deuce Vaughn has more total yards than any other freshman back in the country. He has 669. Nice. He's the only player in the country with 300 rushing yards and 300 receiving yards on the season. Only player in the country with 300. He has more 20-plus yard plays than anyone in the Big 12. And he's averaging 25 yards after the catch. I think the most impressive number out of all that to me is 20-plus yard plays more than anybody in the Big 12. But that's a tough list to pull one from and say this is the most impressive because they're all that impressive. And Ian Boyd was making the point, again, a Texas fan here, all right, who sees the athletes and skill talent that Texas has and obviously is closely in bed with what Oklahoma has as well because of that rivalry. He said Deuce Vaughn has a legitimate argument as being the best skill player in the conference. We're talking about Breece Hall and Tylan Wallace, as I would imagine the other two finalists there. But he thinks Deuce Vaughn has an argument. I think Deuce Vaughn has an argument. I don't know that I would make it strongly at this point, but he's at least in that conversation. And that is unbelievably impressive. And Deuce, he dominated our discussion for the first couple weeks of the season, the first three. And then it's fallen off a bit since then. But we need to continue to talk about what he is doing, Mitch, because you've never been more right about anything in your life, and he is just unbelievable that by halfway through his true freshman season as a 5'5" back, we've normalized a 150 total yard game with a touchdown. It just falls right off your shoulder at this point. You don't think about it that much because, yeah, that's what Deuce does.
I start taking, I wouldn't say maybe for granted what he was doing before he played, but I kind of already had an idea what he's going to be able to do. And what's funny is we think back to the Arkansas State game and think, man, that first game, I think we knew what we got. Make some really good plays, make some moves, showed off a little bit. And really, you think back and think, You know what? What he did against Arkansas State is nothing compared to what he's done in Big 12 play. We just got the oohs and the ahs out of the way against the Red Wolves. And now he's killing it every single game. And I will agree. I think what I've taken for granted from him is his agility and his ability to chew up yardage. And for him to be able to do that every single game, now we're all expecting a big play every game because he's already shown off that he is a big play guy. 70 yards here, 70 yards there, 45 yards against TCU. His big play was 36 yards against Kansas. Yeah, we're to the point now, because it is happening every game, that coming up on Saturday against West Virginia, he's going to have a huge play that's going to lead to some points for K-State. K-State has scored on 59 consecutive trips to the red zone. He's getting them there. He's getting them there. In K-State, anybody can score the football. If it's crunch time, it's not just Deuce Vaughn I'm expecting. Briley Moore, like Will Howard, he's got to make a play, right? It takes the whole group. But just in a regular situation in any game, it's Deuce Vaughn that's putting them in scoring situations.
I mean, it does, by definition, take the whole group. Like, you can't – I mean, there has to be some level of blocking, but a lot of it is just – fling it to Deuce and see what happens. Nothing was there when he juked Gavin Potter out of his shirt. Like, nothing was there, but he made it happen. And that's the kind of thing that we've become so used to. This team and this offense would look miles different without him right now. If it were just Harry Trotter, Tyler Burns at running back, things would feel and look way different because of his ability to take what's a pretty mundane play without a whole lot there and turn it into something and turn it into these chunk plays, these 20-plus yard plays. And it's already become normalized in our mind. And the only players that really do that are the truly great ones, the ones that have a chance to be, as Chris Klieman once put it, generational players. So it is, in a lot of ways, a good sign that that's happened to us, that we've already started to take this for granted. But we also shouldn't. You know, there should be the appropriate level of appreciation for what's going on and what we're seeing out of this kid right now. And I think there are reasonable explanations as to why it's happened, that we have normalized this in our minds and just aren't talking about it on a regular basis as much as we were. You know, one, because obviously we've seen it before, we've covered that territory, but also there's been a lot happening with this team. Like, this has not just been it's not a normal year by any circumstance, but even beyond just the COVID stuff, you had a quarterback change, and when there's a quarterback change, all the focus really comes toward that. And not just because it's such a high-profile position, but also because there's worry and anxiety there. And one thing that I have learned over the years that is a scientific fact is your brain, because of our ancestors, like when they were out just being hunter-gatherers roaming around, right? Their brain was hardwired to pay more attention to negative things and threats than it was to positive things because it was a mode of survival. And that's how we are now. Our brains are wired to more focus on negative things than positive things and focus on anxiety and stress and worry. And so when you have a true freshman quarterback in there in the midst of what's turned into a very good season, there's anxiety and stress and worry and overamplification of that. So we pay more attention to that storyline than we do the big positive storyline, which has been Deuce. Okay, there's also Josh Youngblood leaving. Not that big of a deal to this team in general, but because his name had such value, it was a pretty big headline. That's been a distraction. And then I think the rest is just timing. Because Deuce had the fantastic game against Oklahoma, and he had the play of his career so far against Texas Tech to put the game away. Well, then K-State played TCU, and it was the least productive game of the season for Deuce. Not that he was bad by any stretch, and he's still in a game with limited offense, helped set up points, but he only had 88 total yards. And by his lofty already standards in his career, that wasn't a game that was turning heads. Then you had a week off, and then last week was the Kansas game, which again, he was great, but the focus was taken away from him by special teams, what K-State did there, and just the general ineptitude of Kansas, the general lack of effectiveness of Kansas all the way around. So there have been reasons. I can see how it's happened, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be talking more about Deuce and what he is already doing this year. Because I started looking through, like, I was trying to think in my head, when's the last time K-State had a duo this young with this much potential between quarterback and skill talent, skill player? And you start looking back through the record books. I mean, I know Deuce is still only fourth all-time and on the freshman rushing list, but, like, you start looking back through the last 10, 20 years of K-State football and what he's doing right now, I mean, his numbers are about as good as anybody right now already, and we're halfway through this season. Generational talent, generational player. I really do think the Deuce has that in him. And it's confirmed even more if you go read that article from The Athletic, because it just backs up and amplifies all of the things that we have told you about Deuce and have known about Deuce and the coaches have said, but just the off-the-field stuff or the stuff that's not just his actual skill set. It's like every person that Max Olson talked to from his past is saying just how great he was in high school of a person he was, and like how no one's surprised that he's having success. There was this great quote from, it was the offensive coordinator of his in high school's wife. The offensive coordinator's wife said, quote, "I wish I could just pick him up and put him in my pocket." Now, it might sound a little bit creepy, but that sounds to me like, you know, a parent, someone that's around the team that's like, man, I love that kid and his attitude.
She might be hitting on him a little bit.
Maybe so. Maybe so. But I think we all understand where that sentiment's coming from. And like you just get that all over the place. You also get student of the game who really grew up with his dad as a coach and like taking you through being at Ole Miss and with Dexter McCluster and then at Texas with Quandre Diggs and all these different players that he was learning from. And it just, I mean, I'll be honest, I felt like I knew a ton about Deuce Vaughn already. And I read that article, and not only did I learn a little bit, but it just reinforced everything I knew so much to the point where it was like, I think this guy is going to be, like, we all realize he's great now and we've been talking about him, but I don't think we realize the magnitude of what we are seeing right now and what he is going to be. And that, to me, has already been evidenced by the fact that we're looking at this game against Kansas, 152 total yards on 15 touches, 10 yards per touch and a touchdown, and being like, hey, great, ho-hum, that's what you do. Go do it again.
He chews up the yards receiving, but he scores rushing the football on some short yardage. And I think it's fair to point out as well, you know, he has led K-State in both rushing and receiving 3 of the 5 games so far. So he is looked at as, of course, K-State's best rusher, which I think his success there is taking some carries away from, like, Keon Mosey, who's third on the depth chart. He's losing carries because Deuce has been so good. Harry Trotter's still getting his work in, but receiving, he's been K-State's best receiver. And he's going to probably continue to be the best receiver for the rest of the year until somebody like a Malik Knowles does step up and plays to their potential. But until somebody does that, you're expecting every 3 or 4 plays for Deuce to have a big play. And that's kind of what he's averaging right now, especially since he's only topped 15 touches this season one time.
Well, Keon Mosey may be a story that tells us something about Deuce and his greatness later on, because I will just say, monitor what Mosey does throughout his career, because I had someone tell me recently, we'd all be sitting around talking about Keon Mosey right now if it weren't for Deuce Vaughn. That Deuce Vaughn came in and has been so great that it's taken away some of the spotlight and opportunity that Mosey would have had, because they like Mosey as much as they do already, and he's been relegated to, you know, like third or fourth string duty basically in the offensive backfield because of what Deuce has already done. We're going to talk some more Deuce later on in the show here today. And we probably will with Curry Sexton coming up next as well. I also want to ask Curry, is there really something to the West Virginia trip being more difficult simply because of the distance? He's a guy that made that trip multiple times. We'll ask him next. Back here on the game, John Kurtz, Mitch Fortner with you, joined now by Curry Sexton, former K-State wide receiver and team captain. Curry, thanks for joining us as always. K-State wins 55-14 over Kansas. Have you seen a worse decision recently in a college football game than punting to Phillip Brooks with 8 seconds left in the half after he's already taken a punt return back to the house?
Yeah, that didn't make on multiple instances, didn't make a lot of sense to keep kicking to him. For one, you know, their backup punter he showed that he couldn't get the ball up in the air. And as a punt returner, you know, fielding a punt with 20 yards of breathing room between you and the nearest defender is a dream. So that was, yeah, after the first, I would say after the first two, the second one that he obviously returned for a touchdown, they should have been kicking every single ball, as far out of bounds as they possibly could, because the net punting average was, I'm sure, was near zero, if not even in the negatives.
Well, how plausible is it? So Les Miles said after the game that he was telling the kid to kick it away, but that just wasn't happening. But it happened like two more times after Phillip Brooks had already taken one back for a touchdown. Like, how plausible is it that that's what was actually happening?
Yeah, I'm not buying that. Easy for a coach to go in after the fact and say, hey, I was telling the kid to kick it out of bounds. But when you're punting from the middle of the field and punting directly down the center of the field to a punt returner, time and time again, that shows to me that there is no intent to kick the ball out of bounds or to kick it directionally. I'm not buying that. And I do feel bad for the kid because he was thrown in a tough spot, as the backup punter. And coach throws him under the bus after the game. But, yeah, I don't think that's entirely plausible. If it would have happened once and Miles would have came on and said, I told him to kick it out of bounds and he didn't, maybe that's a little bit more plausible. But the fact that it happened four or five different times, I'm not buying that.
Curry Sexton talking with us. I want to ask you this because you obviously have a pretty keen insight into what it takes to be a good return man. I've had trouble. People have asked me, like, where does this rank Phillip Brooks's individual game and like all-time K-State special teams performances? And the only reason I hesitate, he set the record. He had 189 yards. Nobody in the country, even still, as a team, has that many punt return yards for the season. So there's a lot that's incredibly impressive about that. But so much of it seemed like ineptitude of Kansas contributing there. How do you parse that out and determine how much of it was Phillip Brooks being great and how much of it was Kansas being awful?
Yeah, I want to give as much credit as possible to Phillip Brooks because obviously that's an incredible feat. But I do think you're right. I mean, again, most of those punt returns look like something you'd see on a mid-level Kansas high school football field. Again, you're seeing a punt returner time and time again fielding the punt with nobody within 15 or 20 yards, and that's something you never see in college football because typically punters can get a certain amount of hang time on the punt to allow their coverage unit to get down and surround the returner. And so the fact that that didn't happen numerous times, and that also, K-State is a wall return special teams unit. And the fact, when you allow, a line drive punt that doesn't get a ton of distance, that allows the punt return unit to set up that wall for the return. And so, obviously, incredible day by Phillip Brooks, but I do think that a certain amount of his success can be attributed to KU's ineptitude. It's hard for me to gauge that KU football team against so many other poor teams that we've seen over the last couple of decades, but I was really surprised at how bad they were, and not just on special teams, but across the board. I mean, that was a team that looked like they have absolutely regressed over the last couple of years, and especially from last year.
Well, the K-State offense did have some struggles against that defense in the first half, but then, man, they flipped a switch in the third quarter and in three drives had over 200 total yards and three touchdowns. What really changed and what was clicking for the offense when they came out in the third quarter?
I think they finally were able to find a rhythm. They were mixing up personnel groupings as they always do, but you could see in that third quarter that Will Howard got comfortable, and obviously it helps when you're getting chunk plays from guys like Deuce Vaughn and Sebastian Taylor, and so again you got to think about the fact that this is a kid who's still just a couple of weeks into being the guy, and so it's obviously going to take some time for him to get a true feel for the speed of the game, and I think you start to see things slow down for him a bit in that second half, and he made some good throws, and obviously had some guys around him make some really nice plays. So I think that was the biggest factor.
Curry Sexton talking with me. One thing that's impressive to me, and I saw this even in the first half when it seemed like Will didn't have a whole lot of time. You know, the offensive line was keeping him running around quite a bit. It seems like for a freshman, he has a really good feel for this is my dump-off option. Like, if I get heat, I need to go here with the ball, and he has no real hesitation on that, which I would think that would be something that would be difficult for a freshman to have a grasp on. Do you see it that same way?
Absolutely. I think both and Deuce Vaughn are both, you know, seasoned beyond their status as true freshmen. Absolutely. I think some of the little things that you often don't see from a player until he really becomes comfortable and really gets used to the speed of the game, you're already seeing Will Howard doing that. And it's, you know, I think he has a good pocket presence. I think he's pretty smart with the football. And you're right. I mean, throwing check down is something that you don't often see from guys coming fresh out of high school, because in high school, every play is a home run play. And so for a guy who's you know, 18, 19 years old to come in and realize the importance of throwing the ball underneath, picking up yards where you can, that's significant, because that is so prevalent in all levels of football today, and can obviously help keep you ahead of the chains. And it certainly helps when you have a guy like Deuce Vaughn to throw checkdowns to, and guys like Briley Moore out there as a security blanket. But yeah, I'm very impressed with his decision making. He certainly does not. I mean, other than his physical appearance, certainly does not look like a freshman out there on Saturdays. And Deuce Vaughn is the same way. I think what's really impressive, about him, is as a young guy again, and especially a guy in a running back position, you often see those guys try to break every play for a home run. I mean, you saw guys like Bryce Brown do it. They're so accustomed to running around everybody in high school and to busting big plays constantly that they don't see the importance of getting yardage where you can, cutting up field and getting three rather than taking a loss of two. And you see Deuce Vaughn do that, and to me that's so impressive, and it shows his maturity on the field. So both those guys, very impressed with how mature they are for young players.
I'm glad you mentioned that about Deuce, because I'll see if you agree with this. I opened the show today saying I feel like he had a 152 total yard performance and a touchdown against Kansas, and it just feels ho-hum at this point because he's already set the bar so high as a true freshman. And for a true freshman to be doing that and have us not have that be like the prevailing storyline out of the game and talking about that all the time, to me says just how great he's been so far.
Yeah, it's really incredible. You know, you think back to the Arkansas State game, he made some plays and he saw a fair number of snaps. But then fast forward 6 weeks and all of a sudden he's the focal point of your offense. And he's earned it. I mean, he's, anytime he gets his hands on the football, he's either making a big play or making the right play. And that's something that you don't get that, quite frankly, with upperclassmen, so many times, because they aren't ever able to adjust to the speed of the game. And again, for Deuce Vaughn, a true freshman, to have probably some of the highest football IQ on the field every Saturday is incredibly impressive.
All right, so this West Virginia trip is coming up. It's, I think, a massively important game for this team. I always hear a lot about the trip to Morgantown and how tricky it is to make the trip because it's so far away. And believe me, as somebody who's traveled there, not on a chartered flight, I understand you got to go to Pittsburgh and then drive a couple of hours. It's not easy to get to. How much more difficult does that make the road trip?
Well, so I don't know what the team's doing this year. The first year we went, 2012, we did fly into Pittsburgh and make the trip down. And then actually the next year we did fly into Morgantown. They have a really small airport there in the hills that, made the trip a little bit more convenient. I got to say, that part of the country and this time of the year, and it may be a little bit too late, but the fall, the scenery in West Virginia on that drive from Pittsburgh to Morgantown is incredible. And to me, that was worth it in and of itself. Traveling to a game, it was an easy bus ride because, everything was, it was a gorgeous landscape. But it is strange. I mean, you know, you're used to flying into these big metro areas like Austin, like, you know, the Oklahoma City areas. You used to flying directly in, going straight to your hotel, taking care of business. So that makes it a little bit different. But at the end of the day, it's nothing compared to what a lot of these guys went through playing high school football, where you're traveling on a bus for hours and hours. Is it as convenient? No. But at the end of the day, you got to do what you got to do, and you got to do whatever it takes to get a W.
Well, I realize in asking you that you guys had a lot of success there the two times you went in 2012 and 2014. Did you feel like in general, like that was a more difficult road trip to make, crowd, everything taken into consideration?
It was a fun place to play. I love there, you know, it's a great vibe. The town is really cool. They obviously have a different kind of fan base than the rest of the Big 12. I mean, it's the sole East Coast East Coast mixed with a little mountain man type fan base. And so I really liked it. I mean, the pregame atmosphere was always great. Their fans always said some really hilarious stuff during warmups. And then obviously when you win, it makes it that much more enjoyable. But I really enjoyed going out there and playing. We were fortunate to play, you know, under the lights both times, which made it pretty cool. The one year was a Thursday night game and it snowed a little bit. It was ice cold. That wasn't as fun as the 2012 game. But I think it's a fun place to play. Obviously, this year might be a bit different with the limits on fan capacity. I think it's just one of those things. It's a long way across the country, but you're going there for a reason, and that reason is to get a W and keep moving.
You remember the funniest thing someone said to one of you guys?
I don't. I remember one year, or 2012. I mean, they were relentless to Trey Walker, and I can't remember what they were saying to him specifically. But I mean, it was so constant, and it got to a point where we were out there laughing because it was legitimately funny stuff. I wish I could recall some specific examples, but they're a clever fan base.
But imagine by about like the 2-minute mark of the first quarter, most of that went away in 2012.
Oh, absolutely.
Curry, appreciate the time as always for joining me. Always enjoy it, man, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
All right, there is Curry Sexton with us. I'm actually with him on Morgantown tonight. I said this. I know I made a joke about Morgantown on Bosco's Boys this week. Morgantown actually is. It's so unique, being that it's like in the hills and in the mountains. Like, I actually enjoy the trip quite a bit because it is so much different, but it's definitely a pain to get to. A pain to get to, but once you're there, I like the unique vibe of Morgantown.
It's not really that far from Pittsburgh, hour 15, hour 30 drive. And it's Curry's right. It's beautiful driving up there. I think it's actually more beautiful when you're inside Morgantown because you're just surrounded by the hills. Literally, it's all hills in the city.
Yeah, it's hard to describe. Like, some of the streets and stuff, like, just windy, twisty, hilly roads. Honestly, like, this may sound stupid, but like some of it was almost reminiscent to me of like when I went to Italy, like some places in Italy where I was like, you know. Now, there are also parts of Morgantown that, as my joke indicated, felt to me like it's the Topeka of the Appalachians. But, you know, it's got some of that. It's got a dingy vibe to it in some places. But it's cool because it's so different. Anyway, we've gone way too long this segment. Baseball finally had me interested last night. I am very mad at Kevin Cash, the Rays manager, but not for the reason you may think. That's next. I tell you what, I was as enthralled with baseball last night as I have been in years. Probably since 2015 in the Royals run. It was great stuff. Great stuff! I decided to tune into baseball. I'll be honest, I didn't pick it up until like the fifth or the sixth inning, but I watched every second after that. When you give me juicy headline after juicy headline to the point where I'm scrambling through my Twitter feed the same way I would be during a K-State game or a Chiefs game or just college football or NFL, that's what I knew. I was like, man, baseball has this figured out. I mean, the problem is baseball could only get me that interested when you have the tipping point of the end of the season, the drama of a decisive game of the World Series, an all-time managerial blunder, and then the most 2020 storyline of all time with Justin Turner being pulled from the game because of a positive COVID test, baseball being a mess, and then Rob Manfred sounding so bizarre when he was doing those interviews on field at the end of the game. So my head was spinning with all these different thoughts, and I'm like, baseball, 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 if only it could always be like this. Unfortunately, it can't. But I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it for one night. Everybody is talking about Justin Turner, and rightfully so. I understand that. But let's talk about my man. Is Kevin Cash? Kevin Cash? Kevin Cash. Praise. Yes, Kevin Cash. Kevin Cash should be, first of all, sending Justin Turner a thank you card, because so much of the discussion has been taken away from his decision to pull Blake Snell from that game. And some of the discourse around that is annoying already and is going to be, because listen, guys, like analytics still work and analytics have still won in the game of baseball. Now we're going to get an entire offseason of everybody saying, well, eye test, you got to be a scout and know the game and feel for your guys and all that. It was a mistake. It was clearly a mistake to take Blake Snell from that game. All you had to do was listen to the interviews of the Dodgers players after the game saying, like, yeah, we were happy as hell that they took him out. Like, that gave us new life. It's obvious that that was the wrong decision there. But over the lifespan of an entire season, the analytics do still clearly work. Now, are there some flaws in it? Like, hey, your manager is still going to be a slave to the numbers in a situation like that? Like, yes, okay, learning moment, but that doesn't mean bigger picture that all of it is wrong, right? I heard the analogy earlier today on the Levitard show. Like, Mitch, what would be a terrible hand? What would be a hand everybody would get mad at you for hitting on at the blackjack table?
Oh, 16. Anything is 16. Well, not a 16. I would say, if the dealer's showing a 6 and you have a 13, if you hit, you're going to make the table mad.
Okay. So you hit on a 13, but it just so happens to work out. Well, okay, then that's what you have last night. Like, by the book, the numbers actually do work, and you'd be playing by the numbers to not do that, but sometimes you luck into it and it works, okay? So that's one thought. I have like all these ADD baseball thoughts here right now. But the thing I am most upset about with Kevin Cash for this is the fact that he did not deliver to me what would have been another, I don't know, couple of days, weeks, who knows how long, entertainment out of the baseball season. Because if he leaves Blake Snell in the game and the Rays go on to win that game and then Justin Turner's been pulled because of a positive COVID test, what on earth is baseball doing for Game 7? They would have Game 7 of the World Series marred by the fact that they played a dude who has a positive COVID test in a bubble and has been around the entire team. And now we're talking about testing everybody else on the team, but then even contact tracing with the Rays and the Dodgers. Like, what are you going to have to put off Game 7 for days, 2 weeks? I don't know what the answer is there. Like, how do you make that equitable and fair while at the same time being safe? Like, that would have been fascinating to see how that was handled by Major League Baseball. Fascinating. And I'm so mad that we were denied that opportunity by Kevin Cash. I don't even care so much about the Game 7. I'm here for the craziness. I'm here for the craziness. And I never want it to come at the expense of the health of everybody. But Justin Turner already played and was out there for seven and a half innings in the game, no matter what, right now. So the health risk is already out there. And actually may have been worse by the fact that they won the game because he then refused to actually stay in isolation and went out there and celebrated with everybody. So, like, the health risk is already there. If the health risk was going to be there, give me the pandemonium and, like, the absolute nutty nature of how you handle a Game 7 then if you're baseball. That would have been just phenomenal theater and fascinating for me to try and take it all in and see what would have happened there. So that is why I'm mad at Kevin Cash today. That's my biggest baseball takeaway, that I was denied of the opportunity to see that and how that would be handled.
I mean, I don't care how at what point a manager of a team I don't care about pulls a pitcher in Game 6 of the World Series. It's a chess game anyway. If you make a wrong move, you make a wrong move, whatever. I thought you would have been mad at Justin Turner for coming out after the game, taking his mask off to take a team photo, making out with his wife on the field, and not caring that he just tested positive for COVID-19 being yanked in the seventh inning.
Yeah, I mean,
That was super irritating to me.
Yeah, it's unbelievably selfish and irresponsible, and at the same time, I completely understand, like, all the different things pulling at you there. I completely understand. Like, that's a guy, like, the Dodgers have been through a lot, man, and they went through two World Series of not winning, and you finally won it, and, like, now you're here on the precipice in that moment, and you're being told in the seventh inning, like, hey, by the way, your test result came back positive. You can't go out there. I get everything that's pulling at him, but at the same time, yeah, obviously it's an irresponsible and bad decision that doesn't look good right now. And Major League Baseball is now going to do an investigation with the Players Association, it sounds like. But I don't know. That's not where I'm going to focus most of my ire from last night, because we had, in a topsy-turvy 2020 world where the sports world has already been flipped upside down and we've seen so many unprecedented things. That would have been an unprecedented thing among unprecedented things to see how baseball would have handled a Game 7. And I would have been totally here for it. Would have been totally, totally here for it. If you're trying to go see K-State hoops this year, stay tuned. Yeah, these sandstorm moments, not going to hit the same this year because of COVID. But we did find out today that Bramlage officially announced K-State has a plan for 25% capacity, designated reserve seating, and a socially distanced configuration. That all seems fair, right? Like, I don't think anybody would have major concerns with that, major issues with that. I would think that most people who want to be able to go to games will still be able to find a way to go to some of the games. And, like, you know, the non-conference games aren't all that sexy or exciting anyway, so I couldn't imagine too many people being terribly upset about that. And, you know, the other thing with basketball as opposed to football is it doesn't have, like, the tailgating element of it, which is such a communal thing and what so many people love about the football games and being able to go and all of that. And obviously none of that's really being taken away because just of the nature of basketball. So I don't think you're going to have nearly as much interest or issues in people seeing this release here today as far as the basketball team and the basketball program is concerned. And, you know, we're heading into a time now where cases seem to be going up basically everywhere and you're having problems like at Wisconsin. For instance, right now, their game being canceled with Nebraska and everything they're facing with a 21-day policy in the Big Ten of shutting things down. I think most people would have an understanding now that, like, yeah, expecting anything more than 25% from men's basketball was going to be a total non-starter. I pass along this, too. We're going to get the preseason All-Big 12 poll tomorrow. I would say definitely brace yourself for K-State to be picked last based on what I'm seeing from just quote-unquote experts across the college basketball world and their predictions. I saw a whole panel the other day from CBS. Everybody picked K-State last. So I guess that's what you're going to see, and it'll be K-State, Iowa State, and TCU down at the bottom. Those three teams were the three that did not have a representative on the All-Big 12 team that was released today, and not just the six, which it was interesting. Mitch, you were asking about six. That was abnormal. They did six instead of five on the All-Big 12 team, but K-State, Iowa State, TCU didn't have anybody there or on the list of honorable mention players, of which there were, it looks like about eight honorable mention players here. So no representation from three teams, which is not terribly surprising, and we know that K-State has a long way to go, right? They do, but I'm embracing it this year with the basketball team. We have stated around here it's going to be let's get weird. Let's get weird. K-State hoops 2020-2021. Nobody really knows what to expect. Expectations are low. Weird season with COVID. Bruce Weber said today he expects the schedule will still change by the time it's all said and done. So let's get weird. Let's see what happens. Let's mix it up. Maybe something really fun and exciting will happen. Maybe the next Deuce Vaughn is on the basketball team.
K-State could win in Allen Fieldhouse this year.
It's true. That's true.
This might be the year.
Make it happen. Speaking of Allen Fieldhouse, you will not see Silvio De Sousa in Allen Fieldhouse this year. We'll get into that next. I guess we already knew that, but some more bad news for De Sousa. And when's the last time K-State had a young duo as exciting as Deuce and Will?